Now we're going on to the 9 great questions for references. By the way, please ask questions as we go along. John is not the only one allowed to ask questions.
Back here, Bill.
Yes, Bill.
If you're hiring a senior person, at what point do you share real confidential company information in terms of, you know, vision and financial information, and considering that maybe the candidate may be coming from a competitor?
At the very end. So you could say at the beginning, you know, there is confidential information that I will reveal to you if you're the person we're going to hire at the very end.
When you hire them again and they say, I'm not going to respond to that, it's very difficult, especially in the field I'm in, to find out a little bit more. How do you do that? Because these questions are great, but they're not allowed to answer these unless they want to go.
Right. And that goes back to...
I thought you could answer them. Is the person eligible to rehire? I thought legally that was, you could answer that question. Now, some people don't, but I still love people who...
Well, it's legally you can, but the company policy prevents them from answering.
Right.
And so that's why I try and call references at home rather than at work. You have more of this resistance when you're talking to middle management and lower type references rather than senior management, or if the person isn't truly a great candidate. It gets back to that they're going to protect themselves if there's some negative things there, and give you a name, rank, and serial number if they're only good or less than good.
I thought a lot of companies prohibit their personnel directors from saying anything more than when they work there.
Yes, that's true. Personnel department is going to be the one that is the most likely to give you a name, rank, and serial number. And that's why you really need to go past just that person, if you can, to talk with people who might have been their immediate boss rather than just the personnel department. As you get lower into the sophistication of the candidate, it's harder to get great input from references, because if you're talking people who were their coworkers, they may not be very sophisticated in really talking about their management style or even their working personality. 9 great questions for references. What was most valuable? What about the person's performance proved most valuable to your organization is the first question. What was the greatest reason why you liked having them there? Was it their productivity? Was it their people skills? Did they work well in a matrix relationship? That means across departmental lines where they only have influence and not authority, whatever that might have been. The second one is really a question I like to ask early in starting to ask questions of a reference. What negative thing about this person should I be able to see but feel I could live with? I actually like the term shortcomings. What shortcomings should I see but feel I could live with? And I will preface that by saying, you know, it won't be good for this person or our organization if 3 months into it or 6 months into it we decide this isn't the right fit. So help us to really understand this person. And then I ask the question, what are the shortcomings? Now, instead of them just wanting to say good things, they're wanting you to have a good understanding of the person, and so they're going to actually give you the shortcomings. By the way, we have to be careful that the halo image doesn't affect us. You know, that's where somebody is great in this area, so we have a halo on them, and we just think automatically over in this other area they're going to also be great. That's especially true when you're talking about Christian faith, because someone may be a great Christian, but in the workplace they may not do a great job, or maybe they're into rumor mongering, or maybe they're just dishonest or whatever. Think of this phrase: a Christian bozo is still a bozo. So don't be surprised. You need to do your homework. Just because they're a great Sunday school teacher doesn't mean they're going to be a great person for this job. The next question would be, what types of people do not work well with this question? It was similar to the question we asked of the candidate. But now we need to find out from the references. In fact, the whole context is, what we found out from the candidate, do we get the same answers from references? Likewise, in the next question, what type of situation should we not put this person in? And then the universal, the fifth question is, would you hire this person again? Sometimes the personnel department won't answer that. But very often you can, if they're really a great employee, a great supervisor, and it wasn't prohibited by the company in answering that. The next question is, how well does this person deal with confrontation? There are two extremes, either of which don't work well for us here. One will be this person's not willing to confront. They don't like confrontation. And so they will let employees just get away with things because they don't want to confront with them. And then the other extreme is the person who loves confrontation. They're confrontational. You know, they're in your face. And so you really want to find out how well does this person deal with confrontation and how effective are they at conflict resolution. If they're a really good supervisor, they should be good at it. And maybe they've even trained for it. There are courses out there now in this subject. And it can be excellent if you find people who've done that. The next question is, how easily does this person delegate to others, or do they feel if it's going to be done right, they got to do it themselves? It's a common transition as someone goes from having been an employee to middle management to senior management that they have learned to delegate. Because an executive has to be able to delegate things, or they are going to limit how much they get done. They have to be able also to delegate things if they want their people to grow. So it has to do with their own performance and the growth of their people that they can delegate. In delegation, you also should then have a follow-on question of how do you keep track of things once you've delegated them? Find out what is their mechanism. Because it can be a disaster waiting to happen if they delegate the things and then they forget about them. Because if the person doesn't do them on time, that can really mess things up. So they need to have a mechanism to stay close enough to know what's going on and yet give the person they've delegated it to some freedom to feel like they're doing it rather than being micromanaged. The next question is... The next question for the reference is going to be, how organized is the person? And again, we're looking for extremes as red flags, because if the person is a perfectionist and everything has to be in its place, or they just feel really uncomfortable about it, they may have some problems with people skills or just their own neuroses. If, on the other hand, they're so unorganized that their desk always looks a mess, they can't keep track of projects, that could be catastrophic. So you're trying to find out to what degree are they organized or not. And a common phrase that I look for is what we call new dirt. It's not perfect, but they know where things are. It may look a little messy, but they keep track of things, and maybe at the end of the day it's fairly neat, and tomorrow their desk is so busy that it gets a little disheveled, but they still know where things are, and they don't drop projects. They're good at follow-up. Another question is, do they meet deadlines on a timely basis? I will also ask, do they procrastinate? And a lot of people will say, yes, I procrastinate. And then I'll say, do you really procrastinate or do you reprioritize? How many of us love to juggle a lot of things? How many of us, therefore, procrastinate some of those things? It's pretty common, isn't it? And the way you use the word and the way you mean it can either have a negative or it's not a negative. But reprioritization is something in a very busy person's life has to happen. So you're trying to understand, can they juggle a lot of balls at the same time? Are they good at reprioritization? And then the last question is going to be, who else can I talk to as a reference? Who else knows this person well? Now, you got to be careful, because if the person is presently employed, you don't want to cause them to lose their job because somebody was checking references. But if that isn't the case, and you ask, well, who else knows them well, you can then get to references who weren't suggested by the candidate and maybe get some other insight. That can be really helpful to truly understanding this person. And as I indicate, having 6, 8, or 10 references is not too many in order to understand a candidate. So now why don't we move on to the next section.
Bruce,
yes.
Can I have a question real quick?
Absolutely.
Is that an issue with a person that's employed right now, that you trying to go into this level of detail with somebody that might be over them?
Correct. Absolutely.
At this point, it might actually cause them to lose their job.
That's right. That's why you have to be sensitive. You cannot check those references at this point. You want to be able to check references if you can, but if it's not a dangerous situation, then go ahead and do so. I've oftentimes had candidates where they've been at the same job for 10 years. There's no references I can talk to. And I would say, I can present you, but if you become the candidate the client wants to hire, then we want to be able to check references. But you will have the disadvantage compared to other candidates of not us having the benefit of those references before you go into the interview. So you may not make the top four. But some references can also be naive. And they can give you references where they're presently employed and not realize that their boss will view it as disloyal if they're considering going to a different firm and might fire them. So you do have to be cautious. Yes, Bill.
What questions can you not ask a candidate?
You cannot ask about their age. You cannot ask about their health. You cannot legally ask about their family. You cannot ask about religion. You cannot ask about sexual preferences.
Unless they're a Supreme Court nominee.
Right.
That's good.
Right.
You can't ask about sexual preferences. They're not a protected class. What's the violation there?
I believe that it is illegal to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. So if someone is going to be homosexual, they could accuse you of discrimination on that basis.
Huh. How long has that been the case?
Years.
Yes, a long time.
Are they a protected class, or is that unique to some federal hiring?
Protected class.
It's a protected class.
Homosexuals are protected.
Yeah, and
class.
In fact, handicap and veteran status are also protected classes. Andy.
If somebody puts on a resume some of that data, can you speak to them about it, or is that still a protected? If somebody, for instance, says, you know, Christian, seeking a Christian organization to work for, married, three children, in good health, you know, so on and so forth, all the questions you can't ask. If they put it on their resume, may you address those, or do you still stay away from them?
First of all, any person can sue you for any reason. That's one of the beautiful things of our society. If you were in a corporation that had a well-thought-through HR policy, they would say, don't you dare ask them even though it's there. In fact, the HR department would oftentimes ask them, please give it back to us without that information there, and do not give us a picture. Mm-hmm. HR departments don't like to see pictures because they don't want you to discriminate on the basis of what's seen in the picture. So I think that you are safest when you've been able to have a candidate who's really been so open and transparent with you that you feel you're really connecting.
Right.
And you really like the quality of what they would bring to the party. And so don't go too fast with somebody without getting to know them before you get into those areas that you know could be dangerous. Because if someone then doesn't get the job and they're unemployed, but their brother-in-law's an attorney.
Right.
Yes.
How do you invite them to dinner with their spouse?
First of all, I'm talking about doing it with executives, and at an executive level, we really haven't had a problem with that happening. I think it's because we're looking at truly excellent people who have been very open and candid with us. If, on the other hand, we hadn't done our homework up front and feel that we're dealing with that caliber of a candidate, then I think we would tend to have had the problem. There are several things that are beneficial that come out of when the spouse is there. One of the things is, it's not uncommon with other search firms that haven't had the spouse involved for a candidate to return from an interview trip with an offer and go back to the spouse, and the spouse says, you got to be kidding. We're not moving there. The grandparents are here. We're staying here. I never had that happen. And the reason I don't is because I make sure that the spouse is included in the process early on. There's another aspect to it also, and that is that I look for the relationship between the spouse and the candidate. There's three types of relationships, I think. One is iron sharpening iron. We are blessed if we've married somebody who helps us to be better, that they bring forth our faults. We then validate them and we try to improve and change. We're better because of it. We're better leaders because of it. We're better employers because of it. But another type of relationship is one of enabling. I don't consider the person blessed who has a spouse who's an enabler, who just tries to take care of all their needs and never helps them to be better. And then the third type is a spouse who would love to be iron sharpening iron, but the candidate doesn't allow them to be. Tell you a little story. Flew to Singapore, interview a candidate to be president of a seminary. Sat down to interview them. And I asked the spouse first this particular question was, how easy is it for him to admit when he makes a mistake? She said, not that easy. And he folded his arms and he clammed up because he wasn't willing to deal with his own faults. And he stopped being a candidate. There are some wonderful things that you can learn about a candidate if you have the spouse being a reference. Bill?
Yeah, there are companies that do all these background checks, that do educational, all that sort of stuff. But in some of that information that you may get, I guess it might contravene some of the questions that you can ask that candidate directly. So, I mean, is that information that you get from outside sources, does that compromise you at all in terms of lawsuit?
It can. If you run a credit check on somebody where credit is not part of what is important to their work and they don't get the job, they could sue you for it. When we do a credit check, it's primarily because either they're going to be in a signing capacity on checks for the company or have access to checks and that sort of thing. When we do a driving check, it's not to see if they've got a speeding ticket. It's to see if they've got a problem with DUIs. We were doing a background check, a driving check on a candidate for president of a Christian college, and it came back with vehicular manslaughter. We asked the candidate, what's this about vehicular manslaughter? He says, I have no idea. Well, some clerk, when they were putting down the infraction, instead of putting down it was infraction 45, put 54. Because it was speeding. But it's interesting to do these background checks. Yes?
Isn't the key really knowing how to explain why a person hasn't been hired versus going through all this information? And if it is, then what would be your, how do you talk through a person when they're asking you, you know, what disqualified me for the position?
Yeah, most people are not going to be in a good frame of mind to really take corrective counsel as to why they didn't get a job. And so we tend to, one of the reasons why you want to have several good candidates is just to say, you know, you really are a great candidate, but we've got another candidate who just seems to be a better fit for us. Because they have a tough time finding fault with you when you say that. You can open a real can of worms if you start getting into the reasons why they're not as good.
One of my best candidates I ever interviewed for a job did falsify on his application and gave us false information on his educational background and some other things. And, I'd almost offered him the job, but yeah, you confronted him and said, look, I can't hire you because of the credibility within the organization of what, you know, you've done here. You know, they do look stupid. But, you know, you had the job without these issues. So go clean up your resume, take that crap off, because you'll be very successful in this industry, just who you are and what you've done and what you've accomplished. His references checked out.
Yep.
Everything of his job performance checked out. But he said he had a college degree and he played sports and, you know, as an NFL, you know, rookie draftee. No, that was true.
He didn't need it. I had one like that also. and I was doing a search to find a vice president of research and development for a metallizing company. And if a person had an education that included metallizing, metallurgy, that was great. But all they had to have was experience because it was so unique. And I had a candidate who said he had a master's of science in metallurgy. His experience alone, he could have had the job. All he had was an associate's of science degree. And it's a shame, that, but they're so insecure sometimes that they think they can't get a job. I have seen some great people who've done tremendously well, who've had no college degree. I think Bill Gates and Steve Jobs are two examples of those. They've done okay. But the biggest problem is, if they can't be honest, you don't want them, period.
Yeah. Back to character, right?
It's back to character. It's back to character. Let me move on now to the next one about a timeline for steps of a well-done search. In weeks 1 and 2, I would suggest that there's a number of tasks you want to do. First, you need to write the job description. And I would suggest that it not be just one person, but you get input from people around this position, because jobs will change over time. So don't take just a job description you did 3 years ago. And then secondly, I would encourage writing an opportunity profile, because it has that benefit of attracting candidates better. It has a marketing appeal to it. The next one is going to be building internal support for the search, and how do you handle internal candidates. This is an opportunity to be affirming to the people within your organization. You need to tell them what is going to be the process, and if somebody has an interest, that they should only indicate it to you and not to their peers. And the reason is, if you turn them down, you can say for what reason, but they haven't lost respect for their peers. If they feel like they've lost respect for the peers because they were a candidate and didn't get it, then they may feel so embarrassed that they want to leave and move on. Sometimes they'll say, the organization didn't value me. One of the advantages we have in being hired as an outsider is that we become the person they identify to that they want to be a candidate rather than internally. I remember one chairman of a board saying to us that our fee was worth the price alone as to how we handle the internal candidates, because it that way keeps their loyalty within the organization. They feel affirmed. Sometimes you will find what we call a relative morality reason for being a candidate. They may sound funny, but basically they'll say, well, if the last guy who had this job can do it, I know I can do it. That's relative morality. And the reality is, you may be looking at something very different than what the last person was like. So the next point is, you need to do the research to figure out where you're going to look, how you're going to reach those, and build a contact list. If you aren't doing all of this, you're really not serious about trying to hire from a position of strength. It's a lot of work. And then weeks 3 and 4, we come up with sending out the information. If you're running ads, are they now running? And then the next one is, are you continuing to add more names to the list? Now we move on to weeks 5 and 6. You're getting inquiries, and you're handling those, and then you're asking for more information. I find that very seldom does somebody give me on their initial resume all the information I want, because I want to know from the time they graduated with their undergraduate degree all of the jobs they've had. I want to know something about the organizational structure of that company when they got there. They reported to what position, what positions were peers, what positions reported to them. What were the state of affairs when they got there? What were they able to accomplish? What was it like when they left? And percentages oftentimes aren't much help. You can say, increase sales 20%. Well, is it from $100 to $120? Or was it $100 million to $120 million? So percentages oftentimes that people put in. So are not that helpful. I want the specifics of information. I will also ask for, why did you leave a company? How did you get the next job? You know, it makes a difference if they say, well, that company did a nationwide search and I was selected out of 120 candidates versus, well, my brother-in-law worked there and so that got my foot in the door and I was the only candidate they had. Does that make a difference between the two methods? And you found out just because you said, how did you get that job? So asking for more information is important. And then we move on to weeks 7 and 8. You're interviewing the top candidates, and I would suggest that you not do it just yourself, but include some other people. If you've gotten the information that we just talked about ahead of time, make sure that the other people have read all the information before they sit down to interview. Sometimes you like to have it done as a committee, and sometimes you do it one-on-one, and then you compare notes and say, well, when he was with me, he said this, or she did this, or whatever, because sometimes it's different. Now you want to check the references. You want to check the backgrounds and verify the degrees. So we do criminal, driving, and credit, as well as verify the degrees. Then the top candidate, I like to have dinner with a spouse. Now, one of the things I don't do in this aspect is I don't take more than one candidate and introduce them to all the people in the company, because then it becomes sort of a beauty contest, in the sense that some people say, well, I like the first candidate and I like the second one. That becomes divisive. But if you have one candidate that you really think this is the right person, and you bring them in and you introduce them and say, I'd like you to get acquainted, this is who we're thinking of hiring, and then you get the feedback afterwards, it is very affirming to your people, and it allowed you to have better information making a decision, and it allowed the candidate to have better information so they made the right decision. It's this process that causes us to have such a high success rate. And over dinner, include the spouses, we think is a good thing. And probably the optimal size is to have three couples, the candidate and wife, and you and spouse. And by the way, if I sometimes say wife, it's just because most of the time the candidate's a male. I'm really not against the ladies being candidates. It's just harder to find them usually. And then the last part is going to be making the offer. So if it's a well-done process, you moved right along, it took you 2 months for them to accept. Now they have to give notice where they are. They have to relocate maybe. So it could be 3 months. Yes?
On the criminal driving and credit checks, what do you do to secure their permission and gather all the information you need to get that, and how do you actually do that?
We have a form that we use. In fact, in the state of California, it's law that you have to get written release from people to do that. And so if anybody wants to see our form and then take our name off of it and use it yourself, you're welcome to. Just let me know. But there are forms that we use for that.
And if you put that on your application for employment, aren't you and have them sign off on that, you're okay?
Yes, I would think so, but
I believe most applications in the state of Florida should have that on there.
Right, but do you really ask, for example, for a credit check on all employees or just certain categories?
Well, I think if I'm not mistaken, shouldn't ours just say to our expectation or something? I mean, we wouldn't check everybody, but
right.
Deemed it to be valid, then we would have that opportunity to check.
We have a separate form that we use apart from the application that gives us full right to check criminal records, credit, whatever.
Right. In our forms, we have to get their social security number and the date of birth in order to do it. Also, when we do these background checks, we're not allowed to give them to the client.
Right.
We're allowed to give the client the results to say that there wasn't a problem. But we're not allowed to give it to the client because of the protection of the person's credit history and that sort of thing. Yes, sir.
I know this is an obscure question, but there's a lot of steps here. I see a lot of time being spent. I know you have to go through several candidates. Is it a matrix? Do you have an idea of how much time it would take to go from this point of a person's time interviewing, checking references, going through the whole process?
When we do a search, and this excludes the client having actually interviewed the candidates, we estimate it takes 400 hours of our time. And yet people think our fees are high.
They are high. They better be high for that much time.
400 hours.
But we think that the candidates we place average staying about 8 years. And so when you take our fee and prorate it over that period of time.
I didn't say they didn't have value, I just said they were high.
Right.
My prices are
up. Right. Tom, you had something else?
maybe.
Yeah, it All says
right.
Tom, right?
Yeah, it is. It doesn't want Tom to come out of the email. Yeah, just, I guess, looking at the timeline, what's the progression of, like, go by sales? You see 25 candidates, you interview five, and you hire one. Is there a matrix like that?
How many applicants we have varies a lot according to the position. So we've had anywhere from 15 to 250 applicants. I typically interview between 8 and 15. It's usually closer to 8 to 10 to present four. Why do I seek to present four? Because if at the last minute one bails out, three is still an okay number. And I think that less than three really isn't much of a choice. One of the mistakes I see a lot of people doing is that they will say, well, we want more than four candidates. Yeah, but the reality is when they go to interview them, they don't want to take enough time with six or eight to really get to know them. And so they end up doing short shrift on that. And so I think that if you've really done your homework, do four. If you don't find what you're looking at for, then move on to a couple more. But we find that 9 times out of 10, in our first four, our client finds what they're looking for. Only 10% of the time do we have to go find more candidates. There is one more period to this, and that is the 9 to 12, which is covering the fact that now they need to give notice where they are. You need to think about integrating the person into the company and their family into the community if they're moving. It really is great if you can take somebody and say, hey, here's a coworker, here's a family with similar life stages and similar church, you know, and they're just going to be your friend and help you get integrated. Because we move in a new town, you know, you need to find out, well, what are the doctors, and, you know, all those sorts of things in order to really get integrated into where you're going. And then it's also a good idea to send sign-off letters to applicants and let them know what happened, and to helpful sources. Because you may want to come back to them another time and ask them. And if you let them know what happened and I appreciated your help, it makes a difference. And then, depending upon the position, you may want to do an announcement or press release as to the results of this, that so-and-so has just joined our company as president or whatever the case may be. So those are the things that I had to share with you this morning. I've also got, if anyone is interested, a few of our company brochures. And 10 years ago, my brother wrote a book called In Search of a Leader, which is geared for pastoral searches or nonprofit organizations. I brought two copies if anybody knows of a pastoral search. This is really to help people to do the search themselves better and also so they don't call us. Okay. So I've got these over here if you want them. What other questions might I be able to answer for you? Yes.
First, the comment on the cost. I've used a recruiter several times. You could probably hire at least 10 individuals through recruiter and still doing it. So obviously, you know, I see the value. So I didn't mean that comment to be a dig, because if you get the right recruiter and you follow these steps that you're putting in here, you will get positive results.
If I can just add to that a little bit. Recruiters are like going out for a meal. If you go to a restaurant, you know, there's fast food, there's gourmet, there's all sorts out there. And you hopefully will get what you expected for what you're paying for, but that isn't always the case. We're sort of at the high end of this. In fact, we're the only recruiters we've ever known. In our company brochure, you'll see in here a list of questions to ask the search firm and questions to ask the firm's references. We want whoever selects us to be as well-informed as possible of what it is they're looking for, who it is they're getting. So that's why we volunteer that information. We've never seen another search firm be willing to do that. Once you find a search firm that you really get good results with, stick with them, but it's really sticking with that recruiter. If that recruiter changes firm, then go to that, because it's not the firm that you're hiring as much as it is the person who's doing the work. And also be careful, because there are some recruiters who are really just rainmakers. They go out and bring in the clients, but they don't do the search work. And so you need to also know that in regards to talking to a recruiter. Yes?
On the age discrimination, you know, you're not to ask how old they are, but here's where you put your date of birth on this form. What else what other areas that are not allowed to be asked, but there's another way to get that same information?
There's two things about the age that should be helpful to you. One is ask, how many more years do you have that you could give to this position? It gives you a ballpark of how close they think they are to retirement. Another one is that typically people will have graduated from college when they're 22. And so those are two things that help you to understand on age. But in regards to the other areas, it's really dangerous talking about health. You just can't ask about health. You can't ask about their marriage situation legally. But, you know, when people are really open and candid, and you ask, you know, what other pieces of information do you think would be helpful for me to know about you or your background that might make you the right fit to join our company? If they're really trying to be open and transparent and they're feeling good about who you are, they may just reveal it all. The sad part is that if somebody out there wants to do a lawsuit against us, we will probably end up giving them some pieces of information that give them some basis. Just try not to give them as much as you can avoid.
The health issue, you can ask for hobbies and outside interests, and, you know, if they're athletic and sports, you know, and they'll tell you sometimes, well, I can't do that anymore because I've got a real bad back problem or I've got a heart problem. I mean, it's amazing.
Yep.
Just ask about their activities.
But I've seen cases where somebody has had heart bypass surgery and they go on to give you another 20 great years. And so some of those things about health issues really should not be the alarm that you might think it is. On the other hand, someone who's never had a health problem, the day after you hire him, he has a heart attack. You just can't tell in the sense. Yes, Pam?
Telephone interviewing, can you do some of that at the beginning and pretty much weed out some of the ones that you just don't feel comfortable with over the phone? Or is that not good?
Absolutely. I think that the telephone interview is the time to go through the resume and say, how did you get that job? How did you... why did you leave that job? What attracted you to that job? Get all those details that you want on that resume. Do that on the telephone ahead of time. And then put that information in there so that others are going to be involved in doing the interviewing on your company's side. Have that information when they go to sit down with them. They've already digested it. Yes, Tom?
I was told in the past that when doing that, don't write on the resume. They said, take your notes on it. Keep your separate piece of paper and I got to do a matrix and ask the questions and give them a score because I'm that kind of person. And somebody said, well, you wrote all over your resume. Don't do that because they could use that against you or something.
Oh, yeah, they can always subpoena your records. Yeah, they can subpoena your notes, too.
But if you put it in a different file drawer and they subpoena your personnel records and you have it in a different area out of personnel than you're on,
yes, in the back.
Bruce, I see a lot of interest in legal issues from the group here. And my question, the first question is there a variance still from state to state on your legal do's and don'ts? For instance, California would have a state statute of what you can and cannot ask. And then Florida and, of course, New York would be the most strict. They have more litigation than anywhere else in America. But is that still true that each state pretty much has its own, or is there a federal oversight for all states?
No. Each state does have some differences. You really should have a outside legal counsel who specializes in employment law that you can turn to from time to time. Also, let me suggest to you that a lot of companies in this day and age, companies that have less than 100 employees, which I think might be quite a few of you, that you really need to look at having a virtual HR director. There are some good HR people out there who do it on a part-time basis per company, and they can come in and write an employee manual for you and do these other sorts of things on a contract basis because you may be too small to afford having the quality that you really want. You hire an HR director for $40,000 and you just don't get the quality of what you want. And so, yes, you hire somebody like that to do the personnel management paper shuffling things, but you need someone who is a virtual HR director who may cost you $100 an hour, but you don't need that much time. But you need that expertise from time to time. Yes,
John? Aren't there some surveys on what it costs
in hiring mistakes? There have been some different surveys on it.
There have been surveys on hiring mistakes, and the results are really disastrous in regards to when you make a mistake. And you really can't say that there's an absolute dollar amount for your particular situation. But let me suggest to you that you cannot afford to make a major mistake. And that's why you need to invest accurately, appropriately, in order to hire the right people when it's a crucial position. Let me say something about executive recruiters. They come at all different prices. When it's really an executive recruiter, it's one-third of the first year's estimated cash compensation. Some search firms don't even take assignments that pay less than $200,000 a year. Ours is $150,000 a year in the business world. But there are others that are contingency search firms, and they will do it on a percentage basis that could be as low as 25%. But there is a story about what you pay. It's called the price of oats. Has anyone heard the story about the price of oats? Guy went to buy some oats for his horse, was surprised the price was that high, and the oat seller said, well, you can get oats at any price you want, but sometimes they've already been through the horse. Thank you very much.
I wanted to add a couple other comments because, through the years, I've had a lot of different people talk about or need to hear about hiring, you know what I mean? Because I've seen it is probably the number one issue in a company's growth is having good people, you know? I mean, there's probably other things like vision, of course, and being in the right industry and the right niche and all that kind of stuff. But once you get beyond those things, having the right people to pull it off is so critical. And that's why I wanted to have Bruce here, because I think what happens is that entrepreneurs basically oftentimes jump to decisions. You know what I mean? They want to get this stuff over. In fact, we had a guy talk for years for us who said that, you know, entrepreneurs, what they do is they jump to these solutions rather than taking the time. And what happens is they never hire enough to ever get good at it. Now, they try to delegate the hiring maybe, but so they need to put a lot of time and effort and resource in. This isn't an event, it's a process, and you said that, you know, and the biggest problem they have is not planning well to get started. You know, they plan it as some part-time little activity over here they want to get over with, you know, and dibble at rather than concentrate at, you know, as a major function, almost like they would develop a new marketing plan, you know, or, you know, put $100,000 into a safety plan even in the company, you know what I mean, where they put a lot of planning into it. So I just wanted to reemphasize those things. And I think that basically companies in this group can save or make $100,000, okay, by making the right decisions, okay? Unfortunately, they can lose $100,000 by making the wrong decisions, you know, by people. At least, even in a $1 million company, you know, and it goes, you know, exponentially higher after that in terms of larger companies. But let's give Bruce another round of applause. He's
Let me also say, don't hesitate. If you've got a question, just send me an email or give me a quick message, and I'll be glad. I just don't want you to make mistakes. I want you to make the right decisions. That's my ministry, not my job. Thank you.
That's good.